This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the writer Marion Keyes, author of a dozen best-selling novels. Her writing's modern and witty and pacey, with a pitch-perfect ear for dialogue and a swinging eye for detail. She creates what's glibly categorised as popular fiction, well, given that she has sold over 35 million books. That is, strictly speaking, accurate. But the light and breezy marketing surrounding her work doesn't quite tell the full story. But then, paradox has been her long-term companion. Born in Limerick, she says she grew up in a big, loving, happy family. Yet, by the time she was 30, she was alcoholic and suicidal. Then, along with her sobriety, came her success. She says, "I was born without the rule book. When everyone else was at a briefing on how to deal with life, I must have been off looking at shoes or something. I never felt comfortable in my own skin." So, welcome, Marianne Keyes.
Thank you.
I tried there, as I do, to sort of sum up the trajectory of your life. But as a writer and listening with your writer's ear and knowing yourself better than I can ever know you, what would you say about yourself?
Chatty Irish woman, writes chatty Irish books and has been very lucky.
That's succinct, but maybe not the whole story. Your books have been published in, I think, 33 languages, which is very interesting to me because as I read them, obviously in English, what is resonant throughout is the Irish cadences and the tone and the very colloquial language that is often employed to undercut a thought or a phrase. How on earth do you successfully translate that? Which languages are you most surprised that they've been popular in?
Swedish. With any translation, it's a complete lottery. Like, you've no idea if the translations are any good or what they kind of capture from the colloquialisms and my kind of very Irishly constructed sentences. But then languages like Thai, I have no idea. But maybe the stories that I tell are universal, and that's why people in other countries kind of relate to them.
I want you to tell me about your first choice this morning. Tell me about the song and tell me why it's important to you.
This is a song by Solange Knowles, who will always be known as Beyoncé's sister. The song is Cranes in the Sky, but it's from an album that's like a total piece of work. It's A Seat at the Table, and it's very much a Black Lives Matters album. And it's a very angry album, righteous anger. But I love that she's carrying this very powerful message in kind of an almost a below-the-radar way. And this particular song, Cranes in the Sky, is about trying to fill that internal hole with all the different things, you know, with alcohol, with relationships, with clothes. It's beautiful and powerful.
I tried to drink it away. I tried to put one in the air. I tried to dance it away. Tried to change it with my hair. I wear my credit card below. Thought a new dress would make it better.
That was Solange Knowles and Cranes in the Sky. Marianne Keyes, you've just finished, I think, writing another book.
I have.
And you've sort of come out of this, I'm guessing it's a kind of self-induced purda. You say it's sort of mostly wearing pyjamas and eating pies.
Yes.
Do you feel that you kind of come blinking into the light after the months
Completely.
Of doing that?
Yeah, I had 3 months of like wearing my food and I'm demob happy.
When you finish a book, do you always feel like there's another one to come? Do you think, well, that's that one done?
No, I always think I'm spent. I am used up. I feel like it's nuclear winter. I have to kind of go off and live my life a bit. And eventually it's like the daffodils in the spring, like pushing through the frozen ground, like it eventually comes back, but it takes a while.
What is the sensation that is so familiar to you then when you think, ah, there it is?
It's when I meet somebody and I notice something about them and a sentence starts playing in my head. And most of my characters start like that. And I think, right, here we go. And it's as small as that.
In terms of the subjects that you write about, caring for elderly parents, dealing with depression, domestic violence, I have this suspicion that how you are categorised, you know, in this phrase, popular fiction, well, if ever we could damn somebody with a phrase,
popular,
that might surely be it. Yes, how dare you. Or comedy romance.
Oh, yes.
Why do you think you're put there?
Because I'm a woman, and because, for good or for ill, lots of women enjoy my books and they relate to them. And in my own little way, I feel that they are quite empowering. And I think that anything that empowers women or makes them feel like, hello there, could I have some equal pay? Or how about access to the management jobs? Anything that makes us uppity has to be slapped down. And so if we like something, by telling us it's rubbish, it makes us feel a bit silly for having liked it in the first place. And, you know, I know so many men will be listening to this and saying, but that's not true. But like, it absolutely is true. Men have more power and more money and do less work than women. And money and power and less work, they're nice. Nobody wants to give them up.
Let's talk for a moment about your own power, because surely as an author who has shifted 35 million books, you have plenty power within your industry. Do you have a say as to how your work is marketed? Because when we look at it on the shelves, it does have sort of, I mean, very well designed, but charming, slightly flighty covers and so on.
I am very proud of the books I write and the reach that they have. I'm prepared to put up with a pink cover if it makes me more accessible. I don't see anything wrong with being accessible. It would sadden me to write a book that would only be read by 7 people. It's that choice. But it means then that I am patronised and categorised as a kind of a not terribly clever, my dear.
Let's have your second piece of music, Marianne Keyes. What are we going to hear now?
Oh, it's Petula Clark. It's Downtown.
Why have you chosen this?
When I was about 3, I used to sing it.
Are you a good singer?
I am a terrible singer. But my mother was really proud that I knew the words to a song, and she thought I was really advanced, and she still talks about it. So for that reason alone, because it made my mammy proud.
The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown. Everything's waiting for you. Downtown. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movies.
That was Downtown from Petula Clark. Marianne Keyes, you were born in Ireland in the early 60s, 1963.
Three.
Yes. Yeah. You were the eldest of 5 children, and you have said that you would much rather have been the youngest. Why is that?
Well, I think when you're the oldest, you have to kind of break all the barriers. And I was sort of like a proto-parent, so I always worried terribly about everyone in the family, including my parents.
And your family had moved around a lot. That was to do with your
dad's job, was it?
Can you tell me just a bit more about your parents? Let's start with your mother.
My mother is an amazing woman. She should have been a writer herself. She came from extreme rural poverty in County Clare and moved to the big city of Limerick, where she met my dad, who also came from poverty. She loved her job in Limerick. But when she
What did she do?
She worked for the civil service. But when she got married, by law, she had to give up her job.
Indeed.
And that kills me, because she was so bright. You know, she should have been working in advertising or something creative. And at the same time, she's a really devout Irish mammy, like a real proper, a hardcore Catholic. But there's a wild side to her that never really got the chance.
And so both your parents then, these bright, capable, but very poor people came to a city to sort of make their way.
Yes.
Was that sense of aspiration very much at the sort of basis of the way they brought their 5 children up?
It was a very hopeful time in the 60s. It felt in a way like, you know, things could only ever get better. It felt like a very prosperous, always improving time. But I suppose, I mean, all of Ireland was kind of like this, though, that like you did not stick your head above the parapet. You know, draw attention to yourself, you didn't speak out of turn, you didn't address anything that you found contentious. You were kind of obedient and compliant. I mean, that was very much what I learnt.
Did it make you angry?
Oh, no, it didn't. It made me scared. I was always frightened of saying the wrong thing, of getting into trouble.
And would that be getting into trouble with your parents or the priest or God? Who are you?
Oh, all of them, all of them. I mean, it was an all-seeing, very vengeful God.
What were you worrying about?
I was worried about being late for school. Like, I went through a long phase of sleeping with my nightdress over my school uniform just to facilitate a speedier getaway in the morning.
And you were a good student. You were a smart girl.
Oh, I was right. I was smart and swotty.
Let's have some more music, Marianne Keyes. Tell me about the third one we're going to hear this morning.
It's Message in a Bottle from the Police, which when I was about 16 or 17, they were my group. They are my teenage years. And it was a time when, you know, I was very hopeful that adulthood would make me feel OK about everything. So this is a very hopeful song.
That was The Police and Message in a Bottle. You said, Marianne Keyes, that was chosen for your sort of 17-year-old self, a song of hope.
Yes.
Which one did you hope might be yours?
Oh, Sting.
Yes.
Sting, absolutely.
You've said, I remember at 11, I had a constant feeling of screaming despair. I felt there was an ominous sky nailed 2 inches from my head.
Yeah.
That shocked me when I read it. Yes, I think that's quite a shocking thing at 11 to feel that.
It was about nothing specific. It was just that feeling of kind of appalling dread, but without being able to articulate what I was afraid of. But like, it went much earlier than 11. I mean, I was always afraid. Like fear and shame are my two core emotions. Always were. I've met other alcoholics and they talk about that same feeling of impending doom and that feeling of being wrong in their life, being not the same as anyone else, not as good as anyone else.
I don't wish to be overly cliched, but there is the wonderful Irish tradition of telling tales and the spoken word and listening to each other and the rhythm of the language.
Yeah.
That was everywhere in your childhood,
was it? Yeah, it was. And it might be a cliche, but it was real for me.
Yes.
So it was all about, you know, the gifted storyteller. And like in the house I grew up in, you know, storytelling was a competitive sport. And I love words. I mean, I do have that Irish thing of why use one word when 20 will do. I suppose living in Ireland helps as well. Every interaction, even if you're just buying a newspaper, it's a little opportunity for a mini play. I think Irish people really value words and the fun you can have with them, the patterns and the stories, the tapestry you can create with them. And I know that sounds incredibly cliched, but it's true. And it's one of the things I really love about living there.
Tell me about your next piece of music, Marianne Keyes. We're on your fourth of the day.
Yeah.
What are we going to hear?
This is Ordinary Man by Christy Moore. He didn't write it, but it was written during the recession of the 80s. And I just love him because he's such a champion of those who have it hard. I find it very moving and he really articulates how I feel because I've always been left of centre and he does it so well.
Now the owner says he's sad to see the things have got so bad, but the captains of industry won't let him lose. He still drives a car and smokes a cigar, but still he takes his family on a cruise. He'll never lose.
That was Ordinary Man, sung there by Christy Moore. You said, Marianne Keyes, that that was written during the 80s for the time of high unemployment.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the 80s then, because after you did a law degree.
I did.
Finishing your law degree, there were very, very many young Irish people who decided that Ireland held nothing for them, especially a job and a future. And so they left. in their tens of thousands, and you were one of those that left. You came to London.
Yeah, I did in 1986, and that year 50,000 Irish people emigrated.
I mean, just briefly, why did you choose law, and why do you think that you couldn't get a job as a young trainee in a law firm?
I did law because, I don't know what it's like here, but I got the right number of points to study it, and my parents were so proud of me. But I was immature and I was ill-suited for it. I had that thing of like, nobody will ever pick me, no company will ever want me. I know it sounds awful.
The freedom and the anonymity then that came with moving to
London.
Yes, tell me about that.
It was joyous. I lived in a squat on the 21st floor of a tower block in Hackney with my gay friend Connor. And I really felt, this is living, you know, breaking so many rules. And I got a job as a waitress in a place called the Video Cafe, which was full of out-of-work actresses and models. And it just felt really exciting. And, you know, I slept all day and worked in the evening, then went out clubbing and went home to my squat. And, you know, I'm in recovery from alcoholism now. But, I mean, I drank really heavily around then because there were no real responsibilities.
And what was the sign to you yourself, or maybe actually indeed to those around you and who cared about you, that you were drinking too much?
The sign to myself didn't come at all, because as my addiction got worse, so did my denial. Alcohol was the love of my life. It was my best friend and in the end my only friend. But even when I ended up going into rehab, I honestly thought that I was okay, that I was just very depressed and that this place would be great for me because I was obviously very complicated and needed kind of the finest brains in psychiatry to assess me and to kind of get to the root of my problem. I thought, you know, I was uniquely troubled, but that this place would fix me.
When did you first write?
About 4 months before I stopped drinking.
Is that interesting to you?
Oh, completely. There is a huge connection. At that stage, I had stopped eating, stopped hoping, was constantly suicidal. I mean, there was only kind of one way that it was going to go. Like, I couldn't stop drinking, like, and I couldn't stop. There was no choice in it. And I was kind of preparing to go under.
Right.
And one afternoon, I was at home and I should have been at work. And I read a short story in a magazine and something in me said, you could do that. And it was like literally got a pen and paper and started writing there and then and wrote my first short story that afternoon. And it was, I think, you know, that primal urge that's in all of us to stay alive. It was that saying, here, I can offer you this. Will you live for this? And it didn't get me sober, but it gave me something to hope for. Like, you know, when I came out from rehab, I knew that I could never drink normally again. Like, that was over. There was something else. There was a kind of a rope across the abyss. It was me. It felt truthful, I suppose. It felt authentic and like a proper expression of my deepest, goodest self, I suppose.
We're going to stop for some music, Marianne Keynes. I want you to tell me about why you've chosen this next disc. It's your fifth.
Yeah, it's We Are Family by Sister Sledge. I grew up with Sister Sledge, but I love my family. Well, I have two sisters, but I have sisters-in-law, I have a niece, I have a mother. I see my family every Friday. We go to my mother's house for a kind of a very chaotic dinner, and there are like often up to 15 of us, and there are babies and nephews and teenagers and old people, and it makes me so happy. I love them.
That was Sister Sledge and We Are Family. We had our own little 70s disco
we
going
did.
There, Marianne Keys. Returning from London to Ireland, that happened when you were 30. And it happened because You decided to go into rehab, or your family decided for
you? No, my family decided for me. Yeah, it was decided for me.
Well, obviously that in itself is a very big thing to happen, but also the very act of returning home, of
yes.
coming from London, that place that you had gone to,
yes.
coming back home, aged
yeah.
30, again,
yes.
quite a crucial age.
Well, I mean, I was quite bonkers, you know, going into rehab. Like, I genuinely thought there was nothing wrong with me. It was humiliating, I suppose. And kind of, I felt like I hadn't grown up at all.
What was the biggest thing that you learned about yourself in rehab?
That I'm very selfish, that I'm very immature, or that I was. That I kind of blamed everyone else for anything bad that happened to me. I learned how to take responsibility for the consequences of my actions, right. I think, in there.
Your novels always feature resolution.
Yeah.
Things are made fine at the end,
yes.
whatever terrible things happen in
yeah.
the stories that precede the end. As you went out into the world sober and in your recovery, what did you hope for your story?
I hoped to stay sober. And I have. You know, it's been 23 years and I have never had a drink in that time, which, you know, I've done what I was told to do and it has worked, which is wonderful. I wanted to stay sober and I wanted to write.
It seems that that period between recovery and success is quite a short period, isn't it?
It is. I went into rehab in January of 94 and my first book was published in September 95. It was incredibly fast.
So you came out of rehab and just started
yes,
writing?
I did. And I was really proactive because I had kind of failed at an awful lot of things and I'd failed because I'd never done anything. But I decided I'm doing things. I'm going to send my stuff to publishers. And a publisher wrote back and said, we like your stuff. I felt this is kind of what I'm meant to be doing. It was joyous. I mean, it still feels joyous. Like I've never taken it for granted that this is what I do. Like I love it.
You had said that for so long you had felt like somebody who was not at home in their own skin.
Yes.
So then you felt at home, did you?
Yeah, it feels like when I write, it's the most authentic thing I do. It's the most authentic way I can be. It felt like I was being honest and that honesty was being rewarded, I suppose, was how it felt.
Let's have some more music, Marianne Keyes. Tell me about this.
It's the great Amy Winehouse, who I love for so many reasons. Like in a world of sort of manufactured stuff, she was so real. I've picked Tears Dry on Their Own, but it could have been any song from that album. And I picked it because even though it's a sad song, I have such a happy memory. 2007, I was in my car driving down to Wicklow on a Saturday evening. It was sunny. The song was on my car radio and I was singing and I just remember being in my life and in my body and in that moment and just being so, so happy.
I knew I had him at my match, but every moment we get snatched. I don't know why I got so attached. It's my responsibility and you don't own nothing to me but to walk away. I have no capacity. He walks away, the sun goes down, he takes
Tears Dry on Their Own, Amy Winehouse. Marianne Keyes, you were a very successful novelist, much loved by your readers, happily married, and in your mid-40s when you posted on your website, it wasn't quite a diary, it was more a statement, and you said
yeah.
that you were laid low with crippling depression and that you begged your fans and the people who read your fiction just to give you time to
yeah.
somehow deal with what was an appalling episode in your life. What do you remember of that period?
It started quite suddenly. I was at a barbecue one Sunday afternoon and I started feeling intense anxiety and I couldn't understand it. You know, everything was fine, but everything in me started to speed up and I started to feel like I was dreaming, like that the people I was talking to weren't real. And got worse and worse. And I was in the middle of promoting a book and I thought maybe when the promotion ended that the fear would go away. But it didn't. I had never really experienced anything like it. I stopped being able to sleep. I stopped being able to eat. I couldn't have conversations. And it accelerated. Like the speediness got worse and worse. And I ended up going into a psychiatric hospital, but I thought I'd feel safe in there, and I felt even less safe. So I came out again, went back in again. Then kind of suicidal impulses started, and it was very hard to physically stop myself from going through that. Like, for months and months, every day was an enormous effort to not do the acts of wounding myself.
You said that you had impulses to take your life up to 40 times in a day at its worst.
Yeah, and that went on for 18 months.
You have since written about your depression in an almost unbelievably articulate way, and a way that I think helps the rest of us understand who have not gone through depression what it must be like to go through depression. On reading it, I was terrified at how it must have been to be you.
Thank you.
How on earth did you manage to get out of it? Because you tried it. Goodness knows you tried everything going.
I tried everything. I mean, I did, like, you know, every medication I tried, cognitive behavioural therapy, you know, time, couple of spells in a hospital, mindfulness, meditation, even went back to mass for a while with my mother. And I would do anything that people suggested, like eating, you know, alkaline food, like blue food,
you
whatever.
You attacked it from every direction.
I did. And nothing worked except the passage of time. And I don't know if that will help people, but it ran its course. It's an illness and it ran its course. Like, I couldn't even read magazines. Like, I'd have forgotten the start of the sentence by the time I got to the end. The words would jump around, you know, which was hard for me because I love books.
And yet, at the same time, at the height of it, you went back and found that you'd completed a cryptic crossword one day.
Funnily, yes. You know, it was nothing like I was told it would be like. You know, like, I was far more frightened than numb. My brain was far more jumpy than dead. I was very active cognitively, not the opposite.
And so it healed, the thing healed,
it
and
did.
You began slowly to feel better.
No, quickly.
Quickly?
Yeah. I mean, 3 years ago, the start of 2014, it was like coming up from the bottom of the ocean, and it was really speedy.
And how quickly did you start writing again?
The funny thing is that I had written in bouts, even through the worst of it. And I'd written a book called The Mystery of Mercy Close, which is about a woman experiencing the exact type of depression that I had experienced. And I wrote that because it helped me. It helped me articulate how very strange it was. I had always described myself as kind of melancholic or depressive. I hadn't a clue. You know, I hadn't a notion. Anything I'd had before was just kind of, you know, a blue day by comparison. This was altered perceptions. It was a mental illness. It wasn't about feeling sad or down or low.
Let's have some of your music, Marianne. What are we going to hear now?
Okay. George Michael, who I have loved from the days of Wham and I will love till the day I die. You have been loved. I used to listen to this song at the worst of my times. The mother in this has been bereaved. Her son is dead. And she's still trying to find comfort in her faith. And I had no faith religiously, but I had had faith in my loved ones and stuff. And it was that feeling of when nothing works.
Take care, my love, he said. Don't think that God is dead. Take care, my love, he said. You have been loved.
George Michael, you have been loved. Marianne Keyes, it's been said by great artists indeed that art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life. I'm wondering what it does for you when you write. How do you feel after you've written?
Honest. Like I've done something worthwhile.
Are you sometimes surprised by what you've written when you go back and read
it? Often. I hope that doesn't sound boasty. Because I think writing comes from the subconscious. It kind of accesses a part that the conscious brain doesn't really. So, you know, we can throw up nuggets of stuff that we weren't aware we knew, which is always nice.
What do your parents say about your work? Do they read it?
when my dad has Alzheimer's now, so he doesn't. He was proud, but also very worried about me. I remember him ringing me to warn me that the new Bridget Jones book was coming out and that, you know, my book might be selling now, but not, you know, wait for another week and it's going to be all over. And like, he wasn't meaning to be mean. It was to prepare me for disappointment. My mother, it's more conflicted because she could have done this. And probably a lot better than I do. She also worries, I think, about the capers of my characters. Like, she gives me advice on the sexual acts and says, less of them, please. And she is a little bit worried, I think, about me shaming her.
You live back in Ireland now.
Yes.
And have done for a while.
Yeah.
You said at the beginning that, you know, in the 1980s, the late 80s, you couldn't wait to get away. And now all the things that you hated about your Ireland then are the things you love about it now.
Yes. I mean, the fact that nobody can do anything in Ireland without everybody knowing about it. You know, I love feeling part of a community. Like, you can go nowhere without meeting somebody you know. You know, I still worry about the theocratic elements. I mean, it has lessened, but it's far from gone. But, you know, there is a lot of campaigning and advocacy being done around that, which I feel happy to be able to lend my voice to. It feels like, you know, back in the 80s, there was nothing I could do to change anything. Now it feels that there is a chance to influence things.
What would you enjoy, if indeed you would enjoy anything, about being cast away to this island all alone?
I'm great on my own. I could go to bed whenever I wanted. I like being in my own head. I could write books in my head.
Are you a good, pretty good cook?
No, I'm not. I'm absolutely not. I'm not. I would starve to death before anybody got to eat me.
Let's have your final choice then, Marianne.
Okay,
please.
It's Earth, Wind and Fire. It's September, the song, for lots of reasons. I love autumn. The 1st of September is the happiest day of the year for me. And the year 2014, when I started to get well and I was really well, really quickly. It was the 31st of August. We were in our sitting room and I realised it was going to be September the next day and I was so happy. So we put on the song and we danced in our living room and I was just so happy. I was back. I was better. Autumn was about to start. It just didn't get any better.
That was Earth, Wind and Fire and September. Marianne, I'm going to give you the books now. Every castaway gets the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible and also gets to take another book along.
OK. Can I take a book of cryptic crosswords? Because that'll keep me occupied.
OK. How long does it take you typically to do a cryptic crossword?
Oh, I mean, I might never finish it.
No, but just one crossword? How long?
Oh, it could take me a day.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
OK.
So I'd get good month out of it.
You can have
a
bumper book of
thank you
crosswords.
Thanks.
And what will your luxury be?
I know this is pathetic. Could I have a photograph of my husband? Because I'm really quite fond of him and I'd miss him if I was there on my own.
You can, that's no problem
thank
at
you.
All.
Thank you.
And of the 8 discs that you've chosen today, which is the one that you would like to save?
I'm going to save George Michael because, as I said, I have loved him since Wham. I will love him forever. I want him to be with me on the island.
It's yours.
Thank you.
Marianne Keyes, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been a total honour.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.